Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
Are you doing okay? Why am I asking that? What does the word okay even mean? Today on the podcast, we're going to talk about those popular idioms and phrases that we use all the time. But if people were to ask you, what does that mean? Why are you saying that? You would be speechless. In fact, people might say to you, what's wrong? Cat got your tongue? And then you would ask, why are you saying that? What does any of this even mean? So that's what we're going to talk about today here on the Council of Trent podcast. I'm your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker, Trent Horn. On Mondays and Wednesdays, we talk apologetics, theology, how to explain and defend the Catholic faith. But on Fridays, we talk about whatever I want to talk about because it's Free for All Friday. And so today we're going to talk about these common idioms, phrases, and where they come from. We use them all the time, but their origins are fascinating. So the first one we're going to start with is the word okay. Where does that come from? So in the early 19th century, around the 1830s, a common fad was purposely misspelling words and using abbreviations based on those misspellings. So if you thought that some things that people did nowadays, like, oh, why do kids do that? It turns out people have been doing that for a long time. So think about certain slang like cool, C-O-O-L, that people will misspell it. That's cool, K-E-W-L. It's just like some kind of a hip or ironic thing to do. Well, people have been doing that for a long time. You go back 200 years now to the 1820s, 1830s, people would do that to show that they were hip or in the know for these slang, these popular kinds of abbreviations. So some of those were KY. People would say KY. What does that mean? It means no use. And so you think about, oh, that has no use, N-O-U-S-E. Well, they would misspell it K-N-O-W-Y-U-S-E, no use. So KY stood for no use. Similar for no go, they would say, oh, can we do that? KG, no go. K-N-O-W-G-O. And also, O-W. Is this all right? Yeah, O-W. All right. O-L-L-W-R-I-G-H-T. I don't know why they started doing this. I don't know why anybody does anything, but they were doing this back in the 1830s. But one of the most popular ones was O-K. And O-K stood for all correct. So all correct was a common phrase that people would use on for wireless communications. I think they're using telegraph back then, but for different communications, you'd say all correct. Like, yes, this is all correct, which would then be misspelled O-R-L-K-O-R-R-E-K-T, oral correct. And then they would say okay as the abbreviation, as kind of the hip in joke for that. Where okay kind of entered into the wider vernacular was due to the fact of the presidential election of 1840. So during that time, the Democrats were nominating Martin Van Buren to be president, and his nickname was Old Kinderhook, where he was born in New York State. And so those who supported Van Buren were part of the OK Club, the Old Kinderhook Club. And so this ended up popularizing the term, though a lot of Van Buren's critics would take the OK and then use it for different abbreviations to mean that he was awful, not correct, things like that. So, people were having all kinds of petty political arguments. In fact, if you go back to Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, if you go back to the first political attack ads that people would run, they were absolutely insane. They would say, you know, if Thomas Jefferson or John Adams is elected president, the streets will run red with blood. And it was just so over the top and actually pretty funny. But most linguists and historians would say that the vernacular usage of OK really got mainstream because of that. And when it was first written in the Boston Morning Post in 1839. So now you should know that. Are you OK? Did you understand all of that? All right, here's the next one. Cat got your tongue. Where does that phrase come from? Like, if you don't know an answer to something, or if you're silent, you pause, you ask, oh, you know, cat got your tongue? The earliest use of the phrase cat got your tongue is found in an American magazine in 1881, where it's described as a taunt used by children. One theory is that it stems from the medieval fear of witches and their familiar black cats. Another theory is that the cat referenced in cat got your tongue is not the feline cat. It is a cat of nine tails, those thick reeds you sometimes see on the ends of rivers, for example. and that these nine tails would be put together to form a whip that was used on early sailors that would render them speechless, that the cat got your tongue, a cat of nine tails whipped together, you'd be whipped and unable to talk because you're in so much pain. A third theory is a claim that ancient kings would cut off the tongues of liars and fed the tongues to their cats. So otherwise, we don't know exactly where it comes from. They're all, like I say, there are a lot of these abbreviations, a lot of these idioms that will come about. All we have in some cases are a few possibilities. This one, though, the most likely one is that it's just odd, childish imagery, that it's just a weird thing that kids were saying in the 1880s, 1870s, and it just kind of stuck after that point. Here's the next one, to get up on the wrong side of the bed. What does that mean, right? You know, you get up and you're grumpy, like, oh, I'm mad. Somebody got up on the wrong side of the bed. There's a wrong side of the bed? Like, I mean, how could that be? Unless, like, you have a bed that's leaned up over, like, a sharp drop-off or a cliff or something. I don't know. To get up on the wrong side of the bed, where does that come from? The most commonly accepted origin is that it comes from ancient Rome. And there was a particular superstition during that time among Greco-Roman philosophers, which said that the right side of things was positive or good, and that the left side was sinister or evil. Hence, there's been a lot of discrimination against people who are left-handed, the left-handed path. If you have evil twins, the evil one is going to be left-handed. And so the idea was that the right side is the positive side of things, the good side. And if you arose and got out of your bed on the left side, well, then you were just already off to a bad start. So that's the most commonly accepted origin for getting up on the wrong side of the bed, going back to this Greco-Roman superstition. The earliest citation for it can be found in the Oxford English Dictionary, comes from 1801. Let's see. The next one that we have on here is running amok. Oh no, we're running amok. Not just amok, we are running amok. The term amok originates from the Malay word mang amok, which when roughly defined means to make a furious and desperate charge. So the word amok comes from Malaysian and Indonesian cultures. It's believed that a hantubelian, an evil tiger spirit, would enter someone's body and cause the heinous results of someone running around in kind of a violent rage against others in a frenzy. So amok typically takes place in a well-populated or crowded areas. Amok episodes normally end with the attacker being killed by bystanders or committing suicide among this, you know, Malay culture talking about it. An early Western description of the practice appears in the journals of the British explorer Captain James Cook, who encountered amok, like seeing this, these frenzied attacks in public by a lone individual, during his 1770 voyage around the world. And he talked about how these people were indiscriminately killing and maiming villagers and animals in a frenzied attack. They were running amok. And so that is where the phrase running amok comes from. The next one, paint the town red. You know, you hear, let's go out tonight. We're going to paint the town red. You know, we're going to go out. We're going to have a great time. We're going to go out to restaurants, to pubs, and we're just going to paint the town red. What in the world does that mean? Right? Because how would you connect? Because when you literally think about it, it sounds like going out and painting things a red color. When would you just have fun painting a red color in general? Like, that's what it would seem like. Oh, we're going to paint the town red as a special event instead of just painting at home red or something like that. What does that mean? Well, the metaphor paint the town red, originally it was applied to bonfires, that you wouldn't paint something red with actual paint. But if you started a really big bonfire, and think about if you go back 200 years, even today, I love when I go out on retreats, even on pilgrimages. We've done this before at the Three Hearts Pilgrimage in Oklahoma. At the end of the night, there'll be a big bonfire. We didn't do it last year because there was a big fire warning and the ground was super dry. That would have been a disaster if we had done that. But there's something just fun about sitting around a bonfire, singing songs, telling stories, kids run around and play. And so bonfires will create a reddish glow on things around them. And amidst the bonfire, you're having a really good time. So there's an old Irish ballad that contains these lines. The Beacon Hills were painted red with many a fire that night. So the odds, you wanted to go out communally and have fun. You wanted to paint it red, paint the town red, paint things red. Well, you would have a bonfire to bring people together to do that. The immediate source of the phrase may be traced to the times when a Mississippi steamboat captain would want to defeat his rival. Painter boys, he would command his men as they heaped fuel upon the fires at night, casting a red glare upon the surrounding scenery. The phrase was helped into popularity by the fact that to paint, i.e. to paint the nose red, was an old slang term for drinking. So it all comes together. We're going to paint. When you say paint the town red, say you're saying we're going to go out to a bunch of bars tonight and just have fun. Well, to paint was an older term to refer to drinking, like to paint your nose red. You drink so much, you clearly become inebriated. So to paint the town red, to paint something red with the bonfire, and then to paint your nose red with drinking, it all comes together. You want to go out and hit the bars and the pubs, you will paint the town red. The next one is to turn a blind eye. What does that mean? To turn a blind eye. Normally, it's a willful ignorance of reality. Like, I know something is bad. I know something, I should pay attention to it, but I'm purposely going to ignore it. I'm going to turn a blind eye to it. And so it goes back to the career of the British naval hero Horatio Nelson. And this was during the Battle of Copenhagen in 1801. Nelson's ships were against a very large Danish-Norwegian fleet. When his more conservative superior officer flagged for him to withdraw from the battle, the one-eyed Nelson, so Horatio Nelson had one eye at this time, supposedly brought his telescope to his bad eye and blithely proclaimed, "I really do not see the signal." He went on to score a decisive victory. Some historians have since dismissed Nelson's famous quip as merely a battlefield myth, but the phrase "turn a blind eye" persists to this day. So even if the story is apocryphal, he will tell the story about Nelson going into battle. He's being told by a superior officer, "You should withdraw." You know, he's being signaled maybe from another ship. He takes the telescope, puts it to his bad eye. "Nope, I cannot make out the signal." It's similar to what we might do today. I'm not getting good cellular, sir. I can't hear you, sir. Pretending not to hear it, a willful ignorance, turning a blind eye to it. All right, the next one is a white elephant. You know, you get a white elephant gift, or, "Oh, that's a white elephant." What does that mean? Well, normally we refer to a white elephant, we think of something that is a possession you can't get rid of and whose costs exceed its benefits. So you can't give it away to other people. You can't get rid of it. And it's something you wouldn't really want, even if it's something that is valuable. The cost of having it is greater than the value it gives you. So you'd rather not have it. And nobody else really wants it either. So you only have white elephant parties, for example. You have gifts and you give gifts around one another, and you're stuck with a gift that nobody really wants and no one bothers to take off your hands. That would be a, you know, a white elephant. The origin of the phrase seems to come from the 17th century in Thailand, where Thai kings, kings of Siam, would give white elephants as gifts to those who would insult them, or though, you know, they would do this as passive aggressive gifts, because white elephants are considered sacred in Thailand. They still are today in Southeast Asia. And they're a source of prestige for the monarch and whoever's the wealthy person who owns one, but they're very, very, you know, expensive, and they're difficult for upkeep. It's something that you normally don't want to actually deal with, especially, I mean, if you're a king, maybe it's not really that big of a deal. You have other people to take care of it. But if you're not as well off and you're saddled with this gift that nobody else wants and you have a hard time taking care of, well, there you go. It's just like, "Oh, I can't believe I'm stuck with this. Now I'm stuck with this white elephant that I don't really want anymore." That it says here that it was simultaneously a blessing and a curse. It was a blessing because the animal was sacred and a sign of a king's favor, but a curse because the recipient now had an expensive to maintain animal he could not give away and he could not put to much practical use. In the West, the term white elephant became more popular from P.T. Barnum. I love also, you've probably seen The Greatest Showman with Hugh Jackman. It's a fun musical. I mean, it's not like an amazing film, but it's a fun musical to watch. It's got good songs. But what I like about The Greatest Showman, that it chronicles the life of P.T. Barnum, is that it's hopelessly inaccurate, makes Barnum out to be a far better person than he really was. Barnum actually didn't start his circus and a lot of the other things that he was doing, I think, until his 50s and 60s. So the movie completely glosses over, reworks P.T. Barnum's life in major ways, and basically deceives the audience. And I think the original P.T. Barnum would have been quite proud of The Greatest Showman for doing that, that P.T. Barnum is credited with saying, "There's a sucker born every minute." And so the phrase may have entered into the Western vocabulary more after P.T. Barnum in the 19th century had a bad experience with an elephant named Tung Talung, which was billed as the sacred white elephant of Burma. After much effort and great expense, Barnum acquired the animal from the King of Siam, only to discover that this white elephant was actually dirty gray in color with a few pink spots. So, all right, let's jump into the next one here. And that would be resting on your laurels. We warn people like, hey, you don't want to rest on your laurels. What does that mean? Well, resting on your laurels is the idea that you are relying on your past accomplishments to do a lot of work for you today, that you're not out. Maybe you were a successful artist, a successful athlete, and you're using a lot of the things that you did in the past that got you notoriety and prestige, but you're not doing anything. You're not in championships anymore. You're not writing books anymore. You are resting on your laurels to hope that the past, your past accomplishments will carry you into the future. So the idea of this goes all the way back to ancient Greece, that in Hellenic times, in ancient Greece, you know, the original Olympics, laurel leaves were tied to the sun god Apollo, the god of music, prophecy, and poetry. And Apollo was usually depicted with a crown of these laurel leaves. And so the plant itself became a symbol of status and achievement. And if you won a race, won the Olympics, or won some kind of a race, you were given a crown of laurel branches. So these Greeks and Romans that won these crowns, they were called laureates. And so we use the same term today when we say like a Nobel laureate, for example, these laurels, referring to something that you win by. So that's where to understand the point of a laurel as being something that you win in relation to a crown that is a symbol of your status. It was then in the 1800s that people started using the phrase resting on your laurels. And it was, I think it was around the end of the 1800s when the Olympics are reinstituted. I've talked about this in the podcast before, but the Olympics stopped being celebrated around the 5th century or so, end of the 4th, beginning of the 5th century. The Olympics, because of the collapse of the Roman Empire, you lost the financial and social stability and security to put on the Olympic Games. And so even though they've been celebrated for centuries before that, stopped by the beginning of the Middle Ages, and then were re-celebrated again, I think around in the 1800s. So maybe they went together, I don't know. But it's during the 19th century that people made that connection and started saying, resting on your laurels, to refer to those who rely on their past achievements or bask in their past glory. The next one is to show one's true colors. If somebody does something and it reveals that they, you know, their true intentions, that they've actually been pretending, putting on a mask or a facade about something, you might say, ah, now they've shown their true colors. What does that mean? Well, it goes back to pirates and ships and naval warfare. It's nautical jargon. The colors of a ship are its flags. And so sometimes a ship would lower its colors or fly the enemy's colors of a flag to gain an advantage in a naval battle, or to fly a false flag. We think about a false flag operation. So to show one's true colors refers to this tactic in naval warfare to have a false flag. And then eventually, if you enter into the battle or you're successful, then maybe the correct flag will be raised up. You can say, ah, they showed their true colors. And for the last one, stealing thunder. How do you steal somebody's thunder, right? So stealing thunder would involve sharing something or doing something before someone else is able to do that, like making a big announcement before someone else is planning to do that, accomplishing a feat that another person was planning to do, or to announce it, to make a big deal about it, and rendering that when the person wants to do it, kind of a moot point. You've stolen their thunder. Where does that come from? The idiom comes from John Dennis in the early 18th centuries. A lot of these, we're getting them from the 1900s. People didn't have a lot to do, so they sat around coming up with idioms, I guess. After he had conceived a novel idea for a thunder machine for his unsuccessful 1709 play, Appius and Virginia, And he later found the idea. So he had the idea for this thunder machine he was trying to come up with for this play he was doing. And the play was kind of a bomb. It didn't succeed well. But it was later used, that same idea of his was later used in a performance of Macbeth. There is an account of it in The Lives of the Poets of Great Britain and Ireland by Robert Shields and Theophilus Cibber. So Dennis happened once to go to the play when a tragedy was acted in which the machinery of thunder was introduced, a new artificial method of producing which he had formerly communicated to the managers of the play. Incensed by this circumstance, he cried out in resentment, "That is my thunder. By God, the villains will play my thunder, but not my plays." So he was mad that these stage productions, playhouses, would not host his awful plays like Oppius in Virginia, but he came up with this idea for a thunder machine. So here's this idea. You've got this machine to create thunder sound effects for the play. They won't host his plays, but they stole his ideas for how to make thunder work in their own productions. They literally stole his thunder. So I hope that was a fun one for you guys. Maybe we'll do a part two follow-up. There's all kinds of fun phrases and idioms. We use them all the time, and we have no idea where they come from. And in some cases, we might be quite shocked where they come from. But thank you guys very much, and I hope you have a very blessed day.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.